most important single quality of success is self-discipline. Self-discipline means that you have the ability within yourself, based on your strength of character and willpower, to do what you should do, when you should do it, whether you feel like it or not. Character is the ability to follow through on a resolution after the enthusiasm with which the resolution was made has passed. The key determinant of success is whether or not you can put your head down and discipline yourself to pay the price over and over until you finally attain your objective. You need self-discipline in order to set your goals and to make plans for their accomplishment. You need self-discipline to continually revise and upgrade your plans with new information. You need self-discipline to use your time well and to always concentrate on the most important thing that you should be doing. You need self-discipline to invest in yourself every day, to build yourself up personally and professionally, to learn what you need to learn in order to enjoy the success of which you're capable. You need self-discipline to delay gratification, to save your money and to accumulate your finances so that you can achieve financial freedom and financial independence in the course of your working lifetime. You need self-discipline to keep your thoughts on your goals and dreams and keep them off of your doubts and fears. You need self-discipline to always respond positively and constructively in the face of every difficulty. Perhaps the most revealing demonstration of self-discipline is your ability to persist when the going gets tough. Persistence is self-discipline in action. Persistence is the ultimate measure of individual human character. Your persistence is, in fact, your true measure of your belief in yourself and your ability to succeed. Each time that you persist in the face of adversity and disappointment, you build up the habit of persistence. You build pride, power, and self-esteem into your character and your personality. You become stronger and more resolute. You deepen your levels of self-discipline. You develop in yourself the iron quality of success, the one quality that will carry you forward and over any obstacle that life can throw in your path. The history of the human race is the story of the triumph of persistence. Every great man or woman has had to endure tremendous trials and tribulations before reaching the heights of success and achievement. That's what made them great. Winston Churchill is considered by many to have been the greatest statesman of the 20th century. Throughout his life, he was known and respected for his courage and for his persistence. During the darkest hours of World War II, when the German Luftwaffe was bombing Britain and England stood alone, Churchill's resolution and tenacity of purpose inspired the entire nation to fight on in the face of what many felt was inevitable defeat. John F. Kennedy said that Churchill marshaled the English language and sent it forward into battle. One of the greatest speeches in the annals of persistence was Churchill's address to the nation on June 4, 1940, which ended with these words, "We shall not flag or fail. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our islands, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender." What Churchill found, and what you will find as you move upward and onward toward your great success, is that persistence is the one quality that guarantees that you will eventually win through. Calvin Coolidge, a president who was so reluctant to speak in public that he was given the nickname of Silent Cal, will go down in history for his simple but memorable words on this subject. He wrote, "Press on. Nothing in the world can take the place of persistence. Talent will not. Nothing is more common than unsuccessful men with talent. Genius will not. Unrewarded genius is almost a proverb. Education alone will not. The world is full of educated derelicts. Persistence and determination alone are omnipotent. The key to success has always been contained in the words, press on." James J. Corbett, one of the first world heavyweight boxing champions, said that you become a champion by fighting one more round. When things are tough, you fight one more round. Yogi Berra said this, "It's not over until it's over." And the fact is that it's never over as long as you continue to persist. Albert Hubbard wrote, "There is no failure except in no longer trying. There is no defeat except from within, no really insurmountable barrier save our own inherent weakness of purpose. All of these successful men and women had learned how critical the quality of persistence is in achieving greater goals and objectives. Successful men and women are hallmarked by their incredible persistence, by their unwillingness to quit, no matter what the external circumstances. The one quality that absolutely guarantees success in business, in financial accumulation, and in life is this indomitable willpower and the willingness to stick at it when everything in you wants to stop and rest or go back and do something else. Perhaps your greatest asset is simply your ability to stay with it longer than anyone else. B.C. Forbes, the founder of Forbes magazine, who built it into a major publication during the darkest days of the Depression, wrote, "History has demonstrated that the most notable winners usually encountered heartbreaking obstacles before they triumphed. They won because they refused to become discouraged by their defeat." Conrad Hill, there's an interesting and important paradox in life that you need to be aware of. It is that if you are an intelligent person, you do everything possible to organize your life in such a way that you minimize and avoid adversity and disappointment. This is a sensible and rational thing to do. All intelligent people, following the path of least resistance to achieve their goals, do everything possible to minimize the number of difficulties and obstacles that they'll face in their day-to-day activities. Yet, in spite of our best efforts, disappointments and adversity are normal and natural, unavoidable parts of life. They say that the only things that are inevitable are death and taxes, but every bit of experience shows that disappointment is also inevitable. No matter how well you organize yourself and your activities, you'll experience countless disappointments, setbacks, obstacles, and adversity over the course of your life. And the higher and more challenging the goals that you set for yourself, the more disappointment and adversity you'll experience. This is the paradox. It is impossible for us to evolve and grow and develop our full potentials except to the degree to which we face adversity and learn from it. All of the great lessons of life come as the result of setbacks and temporary defeats which we have done our utmost to avoid. Adversity, therefore, comes unbidden, in spite of our best efforts. And yet without it, we cannot grow into the kind of people who are capable of scaling the heights and achieving great goals. Throughout history, great thinkers have reflected on this paradox and have concluded that adversity is the test that you must pass on the path to accomplishing anything worthwhile. Herodotus, the Greek philosopher, said, "Adversity has the effect of drawing out strength and qualities of a man that would have lain dormant in its absence." The very best qualities of strength, courage, character, and persistence are brought out in you when you face your greatest challenges and when you respond to them positively and constructively. Everyone faces difficulties every step of the way. The difference between the high achiever and the low achiever is simply that the high achiever utilizes adversity and struggle for growth, while the low achiever allows difficulties and adversity to overwhelm him or her and leave him or her discouraged and dejected. The work by Abraham Zelsnick at Harvard proved that the way you respond to disappointment is a fairly accurate predictor of how likely you are to achieve great success. If you respond to disappointment by learning the very most from it, and then by putting it behind you and pressing forward, you are very likely to accomplish great things in the course of your life. And here is another remarkable discovery. Your greatest successes almost invariably come one step beyond when everything inside of you says to quit. Men and women throughout history have been amazed to find that their great breakthroughs came about as a result of persisting in the face of all disappointment and all evidence to the contrary. This final act of persistence, which is often called passing the persistence test, seems to precede great achievements of all kinds. The power to hold on in spite of everything, to endure, this is the winner's quality. Persistence is the ability to face defeat again and again without giving up, to push on in the face of great difficulty. There's a poem by an anonymous author that I think everyone should read and memorize and recite to himself or herself when tempted to quit or to stop trying. This poem is called "Don't Quit," and it goes like this. When things go wrong, as they sometimes will, when the road you're trudging seems all uphill, When the funds are low and the debts are high, and you want to smile but you have to sigh, when care is pressing you down a bit, rest if you must, but don't you quit. For life is queer with its twists and turns, as every one of us sometimes learns, and many a failure turns about when he might have won had he stuck it out. So don't give up, though the pace seems slow. You may succeed with another blow. Success is failure turned inside out. It's the silver tint of the clouds of doubt. And you never can tell how close you are. It may be near when it seems so far. So stick to the fight when you're hardest hit. It's when things seem worst that you must not quit. About 5 years ago, I met a wise and wealthy man who had spent his entire life studying success. He had reached a clear conclusion concerning the reason for success in life. I'll never forget what he told me, because I immediately recognized that he had put his finger on my reason for success and on yours, as I'll explain in a minute. He said that the key to success was to set a goal and to stay with it until you achieve success at one important thing. He said that your subconscious mind will then accept that success experience and store it away as a pattern of success. From then on, your subconscious mind will drive and direct you to duplicate the pattern of success in other things that you attempt. Another way of saying this is, nothing succeeds like success. Psychologists have demonstrated that achievement gives you a natural high. It releases endorphins in your brain that give you a feeling of happiness and well-being. Once you've experienced your first great success, not only are you automatically programmed to repeat it, but nothing else will ever give you the same wonderful feeling of satisfaction. I learned the truth of this many years ago when I first started traveling. In many ways, a trip or a journey is a metaphor for life. My first big trip was that and much, much more. This trip had such an enormous impact on me that I've never really gotten over it. My whole life has been different as a result of what I call the Sahara Crossing. When I was 19, three friends and I decided to go off to see the world. We were well out of high school and working at laboring jobs in sawmills on the West Coast. This was in 1963, and a lot of our friends were heading for Europe to travel around with backpacks. We decided to do something different. Nobody else was going to Africa, so we decided that we'd go to Africa. It never occurred to us to ask why it was that no one else was going to Africa. We found that out for ourselves in the fullness of time. After working and saving for a year, the four of us piled into a 1946 Chevy and drove out of Vancouver bound for Montreal. It was late at night, it was pouring rain, we were all 20 years old, and we were off to see the world. Our plan was to drive across country to Montreal, get jobs on ships across the Atlantic, and then head south across Europe for Africa. However, as it happened, in Montreal, one of the guys decided to go home, and he left us. The other two, after a day of looking for work on the waterfront, decided to spend their savings and pay their way across the Atlantic. I tried to talk them out of it. I told them that quitting is a habit. If you quit the first time you run into difficulties, you'll always quit when the going gets rough. But their minds were made up. So we split our savings, and they took passage on a ship to England. I stayed and worked in Montreal for the winter, and then hitchhiked to Halifax, where I scoured the waterfront looking for a job on a freighter going to England. After an entire day, I had gone through every single ship on the waterfront with no success, and I was on my way back to my little room at the YMCA, tired and discouraged. As I came around a corner, I saw a single ship at one end of the docks that I hadn't seen before. It was perhaps half a mile away, and I wrestled with whether or not I should go back to the warmth of the YMCA or trudge back down to the docks and try this one last ship. However, I had resolved to persist, and so I forced myself back to the wharf. As it happened, this very last ship needed a galley boy for the crossing from Halifax to Manchester, England. I got the job, hurried back to the YMCA, packed my bags, and left on board the ship 2 hours later. I arrived in England in mid-April. As I had predicted, my friends had quit and stayed in England working at odd jobs. However, we made up and once more headed for Africa. At this time, the only map we had was an 8.5 by 11 inch page from a school atlas, which showed both Europe and Africa on one page. It seemed to be a very simple thing to go from London, a dot at the top of the map, to Johannesburg, a dot toward the bottom of the map. Oh, yes, there was this orange part on the map of Africa called the Sahara Desert, but that would be no problem. We just whip over it to the green part on the map below. We never calculated that the total distance was about 8,000 miles. We were young, and we didn't let ourselves get bogged down with details. We went down to London, and there we bought bicycles. We'd never heard of anyone riding from London to Johannesburg on bicycles, and we decided that we would be the first to do it and become famous. This was a big mistake. When you ride bicycles across France in the springtime, you find that the hills are all uphill and the wind is always in your face. Likewise, when you embark on any new venture, you often find the same thing. Everything seems to go wrong, usually at the worst possible time and in the worst possible way. After 2 weeks of slogging along on bicycles, we said, the heck with this. We loaded our bicycles on a train and rode across France and Spain to Gibraltar. There, we sold the bicycles and bought a Land Rover. We had finally learned why no one had ever crossed Africa on bicycles. It was hard enough to get across Europe where there were paved roads. Now, we had a problem. We were broke. We had exhausted our meager finances buying the Land Rover, and we didn't have enough money for fuel and equipment. So we all sat down and wrote letters to everyone we knew, pleading for funds. We received a few dollars here and there, and then one big score. An uncle of Jeff's, my buddy, sent us £100, $300, or the equivalent of more than $1,000 today. We were ecstatic. And this was another lesson. Nobody makes it on their own. We all need help from others to get over the rough spots on the journey of life. With the new money, we loaded up with food and supplies and took the ferry over to Tangiers in Morocco. We headed out of Tangiers toward the Atlas Mountains and the Sahara, full of excitement and singing as we drove down the road. 20 miles out, the radiator blew up. The Land Rover had never been driven on open roads. It had spent its entire working life tooling around the narrow streets of Gibraltar. When it got out onto the open road, it began to fall apart. The radiator was just the beginning. Over the next 10 days, the steering rods bent and threw the front wheels out of alignment. The tires scraped, bald, and blew one by one. We had problems with the carburation and the ignition. We were so poorly equipped, we didn't even have a jack or a lug wrench. When we got a flat tire, we had to sit by the side of the road until someone came along with proper tools to help us change the tire. But we pressed on anyway. As we drove deeper into Morocco, over the Atlas Mountains, we entered into a world that had changed very little in 1,000 years. There were long stretches of barren country, dirt roads, and the occasional oasis surrounded by primitive farms, irrigated by subterranean wells. This was the beginning of an experience that I still remember quite clearly. By this time, I was speaking French fairly well. We could converse with the natives in the occasional small towns we passed through. In one town, early in our slow, halting trek across Morocco, someone asked us where we were headed. We told him that we were going across the Sahara into Africa. He said, "Oh no, you can't do that. You'll die in the desert." The French words were, "Vous allez mourir dans le buste." We then began to hear this on a regular basis everywhere we went. People would bring their friends up to us and introduce us as the young men who were going off to die in the desert. They seemed quite cheerful about it, but we found it kind of irritating after a while. I learned a valuable lesson from this. I learned that for the rest of your life, whenever you try to do something out of the ordinary, people will line up to tell you that you can't do it, why you can't do it, and that you will lose your time, lose your money, that you will, in effect, die in the desert. Even people who should know better will try to discourage you, and to achieve anything greater worthwhile, you must train yourself to rise above these people, to ignore them, and press on regardless. We crossed from Morocco into Algeria and drove south to the desert town of Adrar. By this time, we were sick from dysentery, our vehicle was falling apart, and with the cost of repairs, gasoline, and food, we had almost run out of money again. One of the guys, sick from dysentery, decided to give up. He took his belongings and hitchhiked to the Mediterranean 500 miles north and then back to England. That left the two of us. We began wondering, what are we doing here? We were two young men, both 20 years of age, thousands of miles from home, sick, tired, almost broke, and with thousands of miles ahead of us, including the whole darn Sahara Desert. One of the things that kept us going was a book of poetry by Robert W. Service. He had driven an ambulance in World War I and had written poetry to cheer up the soldiers on the Western Front. There was one poem that we read over and over. It always gave us a boost and the determination to go forward. It was called Carry On, and it started like this. It's easy to fight when everything's right, and you're mad with the thrill and the glory. It's easy to cheer when victory's near and wallow in fields that are gory. It's a different song when everything's wrong, when you're feeling infernally mortal, when it's 10 against 1 and hope there is none. Buckle up, little soldier, and chortle. Carry on, carry on, there isn't much punch in your blow. You're glaring and staring and hitting out blind. You're muddy and bloody, but never you mind. Carry on, carry on, you haven't the ghost of a show. It's looking like death, but while you've a breath, carry on, my son, carry on. We were now in the Sahara, the largest desert in the world. It stretches across the Tropic of Capricorn from the Atlantic Ocean to the Red Sea, 5,000 miles. The part we faced was the Tenezrift, the emptiest single stretch of the Sahara. 800 miles of nothing. Not a fly, not a blade of grass, flat as a tabletop. The enormity of what we had embarked upon finally began to sink in. We learned that over 1,300 people had perished in the Tenezrift in the last 20 years. 42 vehicles had broken down in the desert, and many of their drivers were never seen again alive. By this time, Jeff and I were out of money again. All our tires were scraped bald and needed to be replaced. We needed additional tanks so that we could carry enough gas and water for the crossing. We needed tools. We needed a jack and a lug wrench so that we could change flat tires and do repairs. For 3 weeks, we stayed in a drawer. Jeff hitchhiked north to Algiers to wire home for more money. I sold all our supplies except for a bare minimum. I got the Land Rover repaired and properly outfitted with good tires, a reserve gas tank, proper tools, and food for the crossing. It's amazing how enterprising you become when your survival is at stake. The Sahara Desert in June is hot, very hot. At midday, it can reach 140 degrees Fahrenheit. An exposed man can die of dehydration in as little as 20 minutes. When the French ran Algeria back in the 50s, they required you to carry 5 gallons of water per person per day for the crossing. Because of the intense heat, you can only travel before 10 a.m., and after 4 p.m. The midday sun is so hot that if you drive, your engine oil boils and turns to water, and your vehicle will seize up and never run again. 6 weeks after crossing from Gibraltar, we were ready. Jeff came back from Algiers with some money from his parents, and the Land Rover was in perfect condition for the crossing. We knew by now that if anything went wrong and we couldn't fix it, we would, most certainly, die in the desert. 3 days before the big push, the crossing, we met 5 Germans in a Volkswagen bus who were waiting for a truck convoy that would cross the desert in about 3 weeks. They were going to play it safe and cross with the convoy. Safety in numbers. We told them we were going the next day, convoy or no convoy, and they decided to cross with us. The Algerian government stamps your passport out of Algeria 500 miles north of the border. From there onward, you're on your own, and they couldn't care less what happens to you. We set out at sunset on a Thursday following Le Piste, a French word for track, that led straight south across the desert. As we drove through the night, our troubles began. The Germans' vehicle sank in and got stuck in the fine sand that had blown over the track. It also began to break down and delay us hour by hour. We knew that we had to get across the 500 miles in 2 days, or we would be out of water. So we pressed on as fast as we could, but over and over the German's vehicle got stuck, and we had to stop and drag it out. Jeff and I took turns driving the Land Rover, while the German vehicle drove parallel with us across the flat wasteland in the moonlight. We kept ourselves motivated by quoting the poem, Carry On, back and forth. And so in the strife of the battle of life, it's easy to fight when you're winning. It's easy to slave and starve and be brave when the dawn of success is beginning. But the man who can meet despair and defeat with a cheer, there's the man of God's choosing. The man who can fight to heaven's own height is the man who can fight when he's losing. Carry on, carry on, things never were looming so black. But show that you haven't a cowardly streak, and though you're unlucky, you never are weak. Carry on, brace up for another attack. It's looking like hell, but you never can tell. Carry on, old man, carry on. By morning, we had only made 150 miles, and we were all very tense. There was an abandoned army fort, post-Wiegand, in the middle of the desert, and we had hoped to shelter there from the midday sun in one of the old buildings. Now, it was almost too late. The sun had begun its implacable climb up the eastern sky. Still, we hurried on. You couldn't get lost crossing the Sahara in the daytime. The track across the desert is marked by black 55-gallon oil drums located every 5 kilometers. As you drive, you can always see 2 oil barrels, the one you've just passed and the one you're heading for. All you have to do to cross the biggest desert on Earth is to take it 1 oil barrel at a time. Of course, traveling at night, if you wander from Lepice, the track, you can get lost in the desert and drive until you run out of gas. Many people had died that way. As we would approach each oil barrel, the next barrel would pop up on the horizon 5 kilometers ahead, and the barrel behind us would fall off the horizon, just as though it had been shot in a shooting gallery. All we had to do to cross the Sahara was to keep driving toward the next oil barrel, to go as far as we could see, and then we would see far enough to go further. Now the sun really became the enemy. It began to rise inexorably as we drove south. The temperature got hotter and hotter. Finally, at 9:30 a.m., it reached 110 degrees Fahrenheit. We signaled between the 2 vehicles and agreed to stop and wait out the heat in the middle of that 500,000 square mile parking lot. I'll never forget that day. Hour after hour, we sat in our vehicles, prostrate from the pounding heat of the sun, which reached 140 degrees Fahrenheit and seemed to stay there forever. We drank quart after quart of water, our throats going bone dry minutes after gulping down a full canteen. It was worse outside, so we just stayed there in the vehicles, hour after hour. Finally, as the afternoon wore on, the temperature began to fall. By 4 p.m., it was down to 105 degrees Fahrenheit. When it got below 100 degrees at 5 p.m., we started off again. But now we were racing the clock. There was a small oasis, an Algerian army post on the other side of the desert, and we knew that we had to get there before the midday sun caught us again. We hadn't slept since Thursday morning, and it was now Friday night. We pushed on over the desert, but the Germans' vehicle kept breaking down. All night we worked to get the Volkswagen bus, with the Germans, across to the other side. The sun rose slowly on Saturday morning. We were still struggling with the vehicle. Finally, at 9 a.m., with 20 miles to go, their vehicle broke down for the last time. We abandoned it, loaded the 5 Germans in the back of the Land Rover, and headed for the oasis. It was further than we thought, but we made it before the heat forced us to stop. We stayed the day in a native hut near the fort, and went back and towed the Volkswagen bus into the army post that evening. We had done it. We were over the Sahara. We hadn't slept for 2.5 days, and it would still be another 36 hours before we could stop, but we were across the desert. I won't go into the details of what happened on the rest of our trip across Africa. I won't trouble you here with how we had to cross 2 countries illegally with the police and armies on orders to shoot to kill if they saw us. I won't go into how we were almost killed under the boots and rifle butts of a mob of police in the Congo. And I won't talk here about meeting and working with Dr. Albert Schweitzer in his village at Lamborghini. I'll wrap up this story by telling you what I learned about life and success in the Sahara Crossing. Here are 7 rules I learned that you can apply to any challenge you face in achieving anything you desire. Number 1, the most important key to achieving great success is to decide upon your goal and then launch. Get started. Take action. The act of taking the first step is what separates the winners from the losers. Number 2, once you have launched like a guided missile toward your goal, never consider the possibility of failure. The Germans have a saying, immer vorne, nie zurück, always forward, never backward. Every person who succeeds does it because he or she refuses to quit when the going gets rough. Your ability to persist in the face of setbacks and disappointment is vital to all great achievement in your life. Number 3, the biggest goal in the world can be accomplished if you just take it 1 oil barrel at a time. Don't worry about the distant future. Just do what you can with what you have right where you are. The only time you will ever have is now. If you live every day, every hour, the best you can, the future will take care of itself, and you'll be on your way to making a great life. Rule number four is watch out for the naysayers, the negative people around you who are always telling you that you'll die in the desert. Get around positive people, winners. Fly with the eagles and refuse to listen to objections and reasons why you can't succeed. Someone once said that if every possible objection must first be overcome, nothing will ever get done. Rule number five, welcome obstacles and difficulties as valuable and inevitable steps on the ladder of success. Remember that difficulties come not to obstruct, but to instruct. When you look back on any achievement, you will find that it was preceded by many difficulties. They're the price that you pay for your ultimate successes. Rule number six, be clear about your goal, be flexible about the process of achieving it. Be willing to change, to try something new. Keep your mind open, fluid, and flexible. Be willing to accept feedback from your experiences and self-correct. This is a key quality of peak performers. And finally, rule number seven. Remember, no one does it alone. At every step on our journey across Africa, people helped us with advice, with food, with assistance, with money, and especially with warmth, kindness, and generosity. When life is over, it will be the people we lived and laughed and loved with that we remember more than anything else. So don't be afraid to ask for help from others. It's a mark of strength and courage and character. Don't be reluctant to give of yourself to others generously. It's the mark of caring and compassion and personal greatness. The reason the Sahara Crossing was so relevant to me was because after the Sahara, I never felt that there was anything I couldn't do. I felt programmed for success for life, although it took me many years to understand what had happened. The reason why this story may be of interest to you is because I believe that everyone has a Sahara to cross, perhaps more than one. Everyone eventually goes through his or her own Sahara, his or her own private hell, or dark night of the soul. You are probably wrestling with great challenges, obstacles, and potential disappointments at this very moment. But it's by facing whatever life gives you with courage and determination that you fulfill your full potential as a human being and become everything you are capable of becoming. Let me finish this session with the last verse of Carry On. It goes like this. There are some who drift out in the deserts of doubt, and some who in negativity wallow. There are others I know who in piety go because of a heaven to follow. But to labor with zest and to give of your best for the sweetness and joy of the giving, to help folks along with a hand and a song, why, there's the real sunshine of living. Carry on, carry on. Fight the good fight and true. Believe in your mission. Greet life with a cheer. There's big work to do, and that's why you're here. Carry on, carry on. Let the world be the better for you. And at last when you die, let this be your cry. Carry on, my soul. Carry on. If you follow what you've learned in this... When I was 18 years old, before I set out to see the world, I spent a lot of time thinking about the meaning of life. I asked the questions, why am I here? What is the purpose of life? What's the reason for existence? Who am I? Where did I come from? And where am I going? I'm sure that everyone at some time has wondered about the reasons for his or her individual existence on this planet. Even as a teenager, I'd come to the conclusion that love is the most important thing in the world. I traveled in more than 80 countries over a period of 8 years, working at different jobs, learning different languages, and getting in and out of different situations. And all the while, I still felt that love is more important than anything else. Over the years, I occasionally ask a person what he or she thinks is the most important thing in life. I believe that you can tell how emotionally mature a person is by his or her answer. In my judgment, the only correct answer is love. I've asked this question of leading business people, and I found that even the most worldly and materialistic man or woman will admit upon questioning that, in their heart, they believe love is the most important thing of all. Throughout this program, I define success as a composite of several different ingredients. Each of these ingredients is impacted by the amount of love that a person has within himself or herself and toward the rest of the world. You have peace of mind to the degree to which you love yourself and love others. You have high levels of health and energy to the degree to which you experience self-love, self-acceptance, and the love and acceptance of others. You have loving relationships to the degree to which you love yourself and express your love toward others. In many cases, love is central to your level of financial achievement in life. To the degree to which you love yourself and love what you're doing, you'll set high, challenging, and worthwhile goals and ideals to strive toward. Love makes it easier for you to reach deeper levels of self-knowledge and self-understanding. Finally, you'll achieve lasting fulfillment, satisfaction, and self-actualization in life to the exact degree to which you love and accept yourself and others unconditionally. You are a mental creature. Everything that happens to you happens as the result of the way you think. If you change or improve the quality of your thinking, you automatically change and improve the quality of your life. Several of the mental laws that we've discussed relate to the importance of love and the development of a healthy personality and to the achievement of worthwhile goals and aspirations. The law of belief, for example, says that whatever you believe with feeling becomes your reality. If you love and respect yourself, and you believe yourself capable of accomplishing great things, it's almost certain that you'll achieve far more than if you doubt yourself or if you don't believe in yourself at all. The law of expectation says that whatever you expect with confidence becomes your own self-fulfilling prophecy. It says that if you expect the best of yourself and others, the natural outgrowth of a loving attitude, you'll seldom be disappointed. You'll tend to get far more of the things you want if you continually expect good things to happen, and if you behave accordingly. The law of attraction says that you invariably attract into your life people and circumstances in harmony with your dominant thoughts. When you think kind and loving thoughts toward yourself and others, you attract kind and loving people that make your life a joy and fill you full of happiness and excitement in your work and in your personal relationships. The law of correspondence says that your outer world will correspond to your inner world. If you have a kind, gentle, and loving inner nature, your outer world of relationships, health, material success, and your interactions with others will all correspond to this inner attitude of mind. The law of concentration says that whatever you dwell upon grows. If you think loving thoughts about yourself and others, you create more loving relationships in every part of your life. You have more and more love for yourself and others as it expands. The law of substitution says that you can replace a negative thought with a positive thought. When you consciously control the content of your conscious mind and keep your thoughts focused on love, compassion, patience, tolerance, and forgiveness, you can push aside the negative thoughts that disrupt your peace of mind, your health and energy, and which negatively affect your relationships. Love teaches us the principle of non-resistance. Since, among other things, the Bible is a textbook for psychological and spiritual development, it's useful to note the emphasis on the words, "Judge not that ye be not judged." The Bible also says to pray for those who despitefully use you. When you respond to anger and negativity with love and kindness, you not only preserve your own emotional integrity and positive mental attitude, but, as the poet says, you heap hot coals on the head of your enemy. There is nothing that so exasperates a person as to have someone whom they are mistreating respond to them with gentleness, patience, and kindness. Finally, the law of superconscious activity says that any thought, plan, or idea that you can hold continuously in your conscious mind will begin to be brought into your reality by your superconscious mind. It simply says that you can have a wonderful life full of happy, loving relationships characterized by health, energy, and the experience of joy simply by keeping your mind continuously on the highest and most loving kinds of thoughts that you can hold. Always, love is the answer. The one thing that you can never have too much of in life is love. You can never have too much love for yourself, nor can you give too much love to others. Lack of love, or love withheld, lies at the root of all psychological, emotional, personal, and behavioral problems. Love is not only the answer, but it is the one sure cure for all of the maladies that deprive people of the joy that is possible for them in life. Gerald Jampolsky, in his wonderful little book entitled Love is Letting Go of Fear, ends on the idea from the book A Course in Miracles, which says that the opposite of fear is love, and that love dissolves and banishes fear from your life. Whatever a person's religious beliefs are or are not, no one can deny the universal truth of many of the biblical teachings. One of the most beautiful lines in the New Testament says that God is love, and he that dwelleth in God dwelleth in love, and God in him. It also says that there is no fear in love, but perfect love casteth out fear. These words are important. Self-esteem and self-respect are the foundation qualities of the truly healthy, happy, and effective personality. Everything that you do to raise your own self-esteem will contribute to making you a more successful and happy human being. The wonderful thing about self-esteem is that no matter how low our self-esteem is when we begin, we can systematically crank it up like jacking up a car by doing certain things that we've talked about throughout this course. We can speak to ourselves positively all the time. We can visualize ourselves as the very best person we could possibly be. We can fill our minds with positive books, articles, and audio cassettes containing messages of hope and inspiration. We can associate with positive, optimistic, goal-oriented people. We can make every part of our lives continually reinforce how good we feel about ourselves. The more you like or love yourself, the more you will naturally and spontaneously like and love other people. Remember, you can never have any more love for others than you have for yourself. And you can never expect others to like or love or respect you more than you like or love or respect yourself. The law of reversibility says that just as feelings lead to actions, actions also lead to feelings. If you do and say the things that are consistent with loving yourself, it won't be very long before the actions will actually generate and then internalize the feelings of self-love and self-acceptance. The only true measure of your beliefs about yourself and your values are contained in your actions. It's not what you say or wish or hope that counts, but only what you do. And there are several actions you can take with regard to yourself that will go a long way toward building and reinforcing within you the feelings of high self-esteem and self-regard. First of all, you can resolve to accept yourself unconditionally, no matter what you've done or not done in the past. Since you are unique in all of human history, you can begin to appreciate the special qualities and attributes that you have and emphasize your good points while simply ignoring the areas where you feel you may not be as good as someone else. The foundation of self-esteem is self-acceptance. The second thing that you can do to build your self-esteem is to accept 100% responsibility for your life and for the consequences of all your actions. When you begin to be a self-reliant, self-responsible individual, you will simultaneously refuse to blame or criticize others or attempt to make any excuses for anything in your life that you don't like. You will begin working on the areas where you're discontented, rather than spending your creative energies dreaming up excuses or blaming your situations on others. An attitude of self-responsibility is a fundamental part of high self-esteem, self-love, and personal effectiveness. You can set worthwhile goals for yourself, high, challenging, and positive goals. The very act of setting a big goal for yourself raises your self-esteem immediately. Only a person who likes and believes in himself or herself will even make the effort of writing down an exciting goal. Yet the action of setting the goal is the starting point of becoming the kind of person who can and will achieve the goal and who will deserve the rewards when the goal has been reached. Another way to build high self-esteem is to take good care of yourself physically. When you eat healthy, nutritious foods, when you get lots of sleep and regular exercise, you cannot help but feel better about yourself as a person, and this feeling will expand into your relationships with other people. The ancient Greeks divided love into three different kinds. The first type of love they called eros, and this refers to self-love. Probably 99% of the population never gets beyond a preoccupation with themselves and with their own feelings or lack of feelings in the area of self-love. The primary reason for the failure of men and women to become everything they're capable of becoming is low self-esteem and low self-regard, which leads to eros, or a preoccupation with themselves and their own feelings to the exclusion of the feelings of others. The second form of love they called philios, and this refers to the love of others. Once a person has come together and achieved greater psychological and emotional integration, the natural tendency of the healthy individual is to turn outward toward expressing love for other people, near and far. You'll notice that whenever you feel particularly good about yourself, you find yourself naturally expressing kindness, patience, and tolerance toward other people, even strangers. Whenever you feel blessed in any way, you have an instinctive desire to reach out and help others less fortunate. When you feel financially successful, you naturally desire to share with those who have less than you do. The highest form of love, according to the ancient Greeks, is charis, from which we get our word charismatic. Charis refers to universal love, love for all mankind, and is the rarest type of love in the human experience. Many of the greatest men and women who've ever lived, such as Jesus and Buddha and Saint Francis of Assisi, were and are renowned for their amazing capacity to love greatly. And these great lovers have had more of a positive impact on history than all the kings and rulers who ever lived. Jesus of Nazareth is referred to as the personification of love. The followers of Christianity consider Jesus to have been the perfect man, a person who expressed total and unconditional love to all people, even under the most trying and painful circumstances. It's this model or ideal of perfect love toward which hundreds of millions of men and women strive throughout the course of their lifetimes. Gautama Siddhartha, the founder of Buddhism in 600 BC, continues to be an inspiration to millions because of the development of his totally loving nature. Saint Francis of Assisi is known as a person who expressed unbounded love, even extending his love to the birds, the animals, the flowers, and even the lowly worms and bugs. This standard of unconditional love for all living creatures has made Saint Francis of Assisi a role model and a hero to millions of people down the generations. Dr. Albert Schweitzer of Africa, whom I met and worked with in the 60s, is recognized as perhaps the greatest humanitarian of the 20th century. His overarching philosophy was called Reverence for Life, and he lived and practiced this philosophy for more than 50 years, ministering to the needs of the natives in Central Africa. In our modern day, Mother Teresa of Calcutta has had a tremendous impact on the hearts and minds of millions of men and women because of her actions of unconditional love toward the poor and dying. It's important to note that the word love is a verb, and an active verb at that. Love is not just something that you feel, but it's something that you do. In fact, because of the law of reversibility, whenever you engage in a loving behavior toward someone else, you deepen and intensify your feeling of love toward that person. Many people don't realize that just as you can act yourself into love by doing loving things, you can act yourself back into love even if you feel that the love you experienced earlier has diminished or gone. The Greek word for this is praxis. Praxis means that it is the practice of the actions that accompany the emotion that actually creates the emotion itself. You can act your way back into love by treating the other person exactly as you would if you were deeply in love with him or her. You can maintain the love in your relationship by treating the person as you did when you were courting him or her, or when you most intensely felt the love. And if you continue to behave this way throughout the relationship, you will always have the deep feelings of love that brought you together originally. However, if a person begins to take a relationship for granted and stops doing the things that signify and demonstrate love, it should be no surprise that the feelings of love begin to diminish and problems begin to arise. The happiest of all men and women are those who are continually finding ways to show love, kindness, and affection toward others. Not only are they the most loved and respected by others, but they are the healthiest and the most blessed of all human beings. There's a wonderful poem by Leigh Hunt that has become a favorite of mine over the years. It illustrates what we've been talking about regarding the role of love in every part of life. It is about an Arab, and it is called Abu Ben Adam. Abu Ben Adam, may his tribe increase, awoke one night from a deep dream of peace, and saw within the moonlight in his room, making it rich and like a lily in bloom, an angel writing in a book of gold. Exceeding peace had made Ben-Adam bold, and to the presence in the room he said, "What writest thou?" The vision raised his head, and with a look made of all sweet accord, answered, "The names of those who love the Lord." "And is mine one?" said Abu. "Nay, not so," replied the angel. Abu then spoke more low, but surely still, and said, "I pray thee then, write me as one that loves his fellow men." The angel wrote and vanished. The next night came again with a great wakening light, and showed the names whom love of God had blessed, and lo, Ben-Adam's name led all the rest. An important thing we know about love is that you can never have any more love for yourself than that which you openly and honestly express to other people. Love only grows by sharing, and the only way you can have any more love for yourself is by giving it away. The more you give away, the more you have. By the same token, the less that you express love, the less love you have for yourself. And if you don't express love to others at all, you will turn inward on yourself and become angry, fearful, and unhappy. The antidote to these feelings of fear, doubt, and a lack of self-love is to get out and find someone else whom you can help and serve. The best recipe for unhappiness is to find a way to make someone else happy. Unfortunately, most people have it the other way around. When they're feeling unhappy or feeling unloved, they feel that the solution is for someone else to belly up to the bar and love them in order to solve their problems. Remember, however, that love is a verb. Love is something that you do, a positive and constructive action that you take toward another person or persons. If you practice expressing love, you soon will have no problem feeling and experiencing love. Elizabeth Barrett Browning, the great English poet, wrote one of the most beautiful poems on love ever put down on paper. It has been one of my favorites for many years, and it's called, "How Do I Love Thee?" It goes like this. "How do I love thee? Let me count the ways. I love thee to the depth and breadth and height my soul can reach when feeling out of sight for the ends of being and ideal grace. I love thee to the level of every day's most quiet need by sun and candlelight. I love thee freely as men strive for right. I love thee purely as they turn from praise. I love thee with the passion put to use in my old griefs and with my childhood faith. I love thee with a love I seem to lose with my lost saints. I love thee with the breath, smiles, tears of all my life, and if God choose, I shall but love thee better after death." Throughout all the ages, the wisest men and women have come to the conclusion that nothing is more important than the quality and quantity of the love that you experience in your life. And since you're a self-responsible individual, it's up to you to improve the quality of your life by increasing and improving your expression of love to others. Perhaps the greatest single obstacle to the experience and expression of love is negative emotion, especially the negative emotions of fear, anger, guilt, and resentment. Almost everyone is still harboring negative feelings towards someone who has hurt them sometime earlier in their lives. Many people carry anger and resentment toward their parents for 40 or 50 years, if not into the grave. It's not unusual for a man or woman to still be angry and resentful toward someone in a previous relationship or marriage. Often a bad business deal or a job or career or a business venture that doesn't succeed can generate these feelings of anger or unhappiness. And if the person clings to these feelings by dwelling on them, he or she keeps them alive year after year, long after the incident has passed. The most powerful way to clear your mind and heart of all negativity that is built up over the course of your lifetime is to issue a blanket pardon to everyone for everything that they have ever done to hurt you in any way. The answer is forgiveness. Your ability to freely forgive other people and to let the hurt go is the true mark of integrity, courage, and character. The great tragedy is that many people cling to their resentments because they feel that they have paid so dearly for them that they cannot possibly give them up. Sometimes a person's entire life is built around their hurt and their suffering. They have little else to talk about, and they think about the negative experience or experiences continually. Eventually, these people make themselves physically and mentally ill. They carry with them the anger and negativity that eventually erupts and spoils any new relationships that they try to build. And in every case, there is only one solution, and that is to forgive and let it go. Remember, forgiving another person is a perfectly selfish act. You do it so that you can be free and so that you can experience the happiness and joy for which you were created. Here's a little test for you. If you have truly forgiven another person, you can prove it to yourself by doing the other person a favor or sending the other person a gift. When you do this, you demonstrate to yourself once and for all that you are finally free of all the negativity associated with that memory. However, if you find that you still can't bring yourself to do a kindness for the other person, that should tell you something about what might be holding you back from the experience and the expression of love in your life towards yourself and other people. One of the most beautiful parts of the New Testament, in my estimation, is 1 Corinthians chapter 13. My wife and I had this entire passage read at our wedding, and I think it's one of the most beautiful pieces of writing ever written in any language. It goes like this. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not love, I am become as sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains and have not love, I am nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned and have not love, it profiteth me nothing. Love suffereth long and is kind. Love envieth not. Love vaunteth not itself, is not puffed up. Love does not behave itself unseemly. Love seeketh not her own. Love is not easily provoked, and love thinketh no evil. Love rejoiceth not in iniquity, but rejoiceth in the truth. Love bears all things, believeth all things, hopeth all things, endureth all things. Love never faileth, but whether they be prophecies, they shall fail. Whether there shall be tongues, they shall cease. Whether there shall be knowledge, it shall vanish away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when that which is perfect is come, then that which is in part shall be done away. When I was a child, I spake as a child. I understood as a child. I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see through a glass, darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then shall I know even as also I am known. And now abideth faith, hope, love, these three. But the greatest of these is love. Many wise and intelligent men have written long explanations of the inner meanings of 1 Corinthians chapter 13. But it's safe to say that what this passage tells us is that when we become totally loving beings, we will understand all, forgive all, and experience true joy in every part of our lives. One of the most important times to be loving is when you feel the least like loving. The time to draw on your reserves of patience, tolerance, and compassion is when you least feel like it toward another person. Remember that obnoxious or unpleasant behavior is merely a cry for help. It's a way of expressing the frustration of not feeling truly loved and accepted. There's wisdom in the words, "A gentle answer turneth away wrath." Whenever you deal with a difficult people situation in a calm, patient, and loving way, you will actually see a human miracle. You will see attitudes and behaviors change. You will see difficult people soften up and brighten and alter their behaviors. More than anything, by acting in a loving way, you will maintain your emotional and personal integrity. Although you and I cannot change the world, we can present the world with one improved person, ourselves. We can go to work on ourselves to make ourselves into the kind of people that we admire and respect, and by so doing, we will become a role model and an example to others. We can exert self-control and self-discipline to resist acting or speaking in a negative way toward anyone for any reason. We can insist upon always doing things the loving way rather than the reactive way. We can keep our minds clear and positive by thinking kind and loving thoughts about others, especially those who seem to least deserve it, but who probably need it the most. We can throw cold water on our anger by praying for those who despitefully use us. Whenever you say something like, God bless him or God bless her, rather than thinking about how much he or she is exasperating you, you neutralize your negative emotions and restore your calmness and clarity of mind. You take another giant step on the pathway toward becoming an exceptional human being. Someone once said, with all thy getting, get love. Everything that we will ever read about the meaning and purpose of life will bring us back to the idea and the importance of love. Everything that we do to build up love for ourselves will make us more capable of expressing love toward other people. And every time we do or say anything kind or loving toward another person, we increase the amount of love that we have inside for ourselves. Every time we engage in a loving act, we make the world a better place in which to live. Each time we express love toward someone who needs it, or even toward someone who apparently does not, we enrich and enhance the quality of his or her life while simultaneously enriching and uplifting ourselves. My favorite piece of writing on love is by Emmett Fox in his short little one-page summary called The Golden Gate. This is what he writes. Love is by far the most important thing of all. Love casts out fear. It covers a multitude of sins. It is absolutely invincible. There is no difficulty that enough love will not conquer. No disease that enough love will not heal. No door that enough love will not open. No gulf that enough love will not bridge. No wall that enough love will not throw down. No sin that enough love will not redeem. It makes no difference how deeply seated may be the trouble, how hopeless the outlook, how muddled the tangle, how great the mistake. A sufficient realization of love will dissolve it all. If only you could love enough, you would be the happiest and the most powerful being in the world. My advice to you, if you truly want to be successful and happy in everything that you do, in every aspect of your life, is to learn and practice love at every opportunity. Some years ago, I met a lovely woman, a grandmother, who told me a story. She told me she had been raised in a home with truly loving parents, parents who taught her and her brothers and sisters how important it was to express and feel love for everyone, no matter how angry or unhappy they made you. When both of her parents had passed away, the brothers and sisters got together to divide their possessions. This woman was married to a wealthy industrialist, and so she had no financial needs. In fact, there was only one thing she wanted from the home of her parents, and it was a plaque that had stood over the fireplace in the living room throughout all the years that she was growing up. Her parents would often refer to the plaque when a problem arose with another person, and the advice on the plaque was what had guided her throughout her adult life. These were the words on the plaque. Only one life that soon is past, only what's done with love will last. These words will guide you and assure you that you achieve all the great happiness and success that you desire in life.